Poetry on the radio, poetry in and around the ACT. This week, we conclude our discussion with veteran poet, translator, and all-around man of letters, Keith Harrison, plus the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For Art Sound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. If you've been listening to Poetry on the Radio over the last couple of weeks, and you can always go online to our program page at Art Sound FM to listen back, you'll be familiar with the rich and varied career of Keith Harrison. He has published 10 collections of poetry, as well as an acclaimed translation of the 14th century narrative poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, which appears in the Oxford World's Classics series. He also has 2 radio plays and a book on writing called How to Stop Your Papers from Killing You and Me. Today, we speak with him about that book about writing and also his translation of Sir Gawain. And by the way, a radio drama version of his translation is in production here at ArtSound. More about that in coming weeks. This week, we start by hearing more from him about that translation, specifically how he dealt with its 14th century regional English and distinctive poetic structure. Here's how the poem begins in Keith's own reading of his translation.
After the attack and the battle were over at Troy, the town beaten down to smoking brands and ashes, that man enmeshed in the nets of treachery, the truest of men, was tried for treason, I mean Aeneas, the highborn, who, with his noble kinsmen, conquered many countries and made themselves masters of almost all the wealth of the Western Isles. Romulus goes off in haste toward Rome, raises at first that fine city with pride, bestowing on her his famous name, which she still has now. Titius builds new towns in Tuscany, and Langobard lays out homes in Lombardy, and joyfully, far over the French sea, Felix Brutus founds Britain by ample down and bay, where war and joy and terror have all at times held sway, where both delight and horror have had their fitful day. And after Britain was founded by this brave fighter, rough fellows were fathered here who relished a fray and made much mischief in troubled times. More marvels have occurred in this country than any other since then, so far as I know. But of all the kings who've commanded this land, men say King Arthur was the greatest in courtesy. Let me tell you then a tale of adventure, a most striking one among the marvels of Arthur, which some will consider a wonder to hear. If you listen closely to my words a little while, I'll tell it to you now as I heard it told in town. A bold story, well proven, and everywhere well known, the letters all interwoven as custom sets it down.
Talk to us a bit, would you, about what you're trying to achieve with that translation, which I should say is published by Oxford University Press in its Oxford World's Classics series.
I worked on it like mad for a whole year. And I had this feeling when I was going to bed at night time, I'd get to the little wheel at the end, the little quatrain at the end. And when I got that right, which wasn't all that often, I had this illusion, wonderful illusion, that I could hear the Gawain poet saying to me, not bad, not bad at all. What fascinated me about it was that it has this sharp, strong imagery in it. And I really like that. And it's a beautifully written story. I mean, it's a masterpiece of writing. We don't know the author. We call him the Gawain poet. He was writing at the same time as Chaucer. Chaucer hated the kind of poetry that he was writing, because he called it rim-ram-ruff. It had this, you know, this over-alliterative quality to it. Chaucer was, his nose was set in a totally different direction of having listened to the Italians and the French. He wanted that sweet singing sound that we get in the iambic pentameter, so that you hear Chaucer and he says, a thousand teemers have heard men tell her that there is joy in heaven and pain in hell. And you think, oh, this has got a voice to it that is so warm. It's the voice of a man talking while he's walking. So you get a great sense of leisure. And I think a great deal of English poetry is in that mode, whereas a great deal of French poetry is not. French poetry tends to be more cantabile. It's more of a chant, you know. Whereas the English poetry has got this sense of a kind of Browning's got it, and Wordsworth has it. Milton hasn't got it. Keats has got it. Shelley's got it. A talking quality. And the original poetry in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the original language, doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds more like this. Sis and the Seg and the assault were cessed at Troy. The boar Britoned and brent to Bronders and Uskers. The talk that the tremors of treason there wrought was treed for his treachery, the truest on earth. And it sounds like a drum being beaten by a fellow who's slightly mad, you know. After a while, you get used to it. That would have been probably done with either a zither and a drum or with a drum on its own. And it was written to be performed. If you get one of the sounds on the line right, you can drive that sound across. There are four sounds on the line. If you do it in modern English, it sounds really strange. And it doesn't sound convincing. You take the original, Sith and the Seg and the Assault was cessed at Troy. You get four S sounds in the line, and you get one rogue sound. So there's four alliterations and a sound that doesn't belong to that pattern on five stress beats. Now, if you do a stress in English on and you have the sound on five stress beats, it sounds as if the person is just dying. It sounds like very, very bad Gerard Manley Hopkins. And I want to do something which was convincing to an audience listening over the radio. And I originally had that in mind for it to be done on radio. And I wanted to get a sense of the alliteration. So I thought I'll take two sounds. So here's one line that comes to mind. It's clear there's no one here but beardless boys. So that you get clear and here and B and B. And I thought, okay, you've got four sounds. You've got four sounds, two pairs of sounds. You can do them A-A, B-B, or A-B-B-A, or A-B-A-B. So you've got three possibilities. And I thought, if I stick to that, then I'll be able to have something, if I was reading, something to cling on to myself and maybe another reader. But it wouldn't be so pronounced that you'd feel that you were listening to, I caught this morning's morning minion kingdom of daylight's dwarfed and dappled dawn-drawn falcon. I didn't want that effect at all because you tend to pay attention to the surface, not to the meaning of the words. I kind of compromised, but...
But as great as the accomplishment of the original poet was to structure a poem, a long narrative poem in that way, it speaks to the amount of work that you must have had to do to render it into the form you did.
It's joyful work, you know, because I learned an enormous amount from it about how to make sounds talk to each other in poems. And you get it in Heaney and you get it in Eliot and you get it in Robert Lowell and a few other people where you can feel that the poem is intact because it's echoing sounds and you get half rhymes and that kind of thing. And it was a very joyful, it was bloody hard work, I can tell you, too. It was the kind of hard work you do when you're practicing your tennis serve. You feel, oh, I'm getting somewhere. I've got the wrist snap today. I didn't have that yesterday.
The range of poets that you've translated, they're very, very different. They range from Virgil to Catullus to Rilke, Lorca, Pushkin, Baudelaire and Francis Jammes.
Francis Jammes, at the early part of this century, was very popular in France. He did something very unusual in French poetry. Most French poetry, as I said a while ago, is cantable. It's, you know, Sois tranquille ou marche des colombes, entre les pins palpite. Sounds like Robert Bly on a bad day. You know? Francis Jammes did something unusual. He broke out of that and he wrote a lovely poem about an older person sitting in his study in front of a fire and just talking about how he felt last year at this time with the snow falling down. And in French it goes like this, il va neiger en quelques jours. Je me souviens de l'an dernier. Je me souviens de mes tristesses au coin du feu. It's just, it's got this lovely talking quality. So I tried to do that. In a few days, it's going to snow. I remember myself a year ago feeling bleak by a deadfall fire. If anybody had come by then to inquire what's wrong, I would have said, leave me be. It's nothing. Nothing at all. It doesn't sound like French poetry in the French, and I tried to echo that sort of talking quality. It's a lovely poem. There's some more about translation. The Virgil was an even larger challenge because I tried to translate Virgil's Mantua and the era after a great world war, when the farmers were sent back to the, when the soldiers were sent back to the countryside with no experience of being soldiers, like they were in this country, sent to the Mallee. It's exactly the same thing we repeated 2,000 years earlier, or later, I mean. And I wanted to get a sense of the landscape in Minnesota for that poem. So I translated the setting into, I've got Minnesotan or Midwestern weeds and things in there, you know, which is a mistranslation. So it's a much freer translation. But it's a song of the earth. It's an instruction manual for young farmers going back after the war with no experience.
You've written a book called How to Stop Your Papers from Killing You and Me. It's an encouragement to students and to their professors to emphasize the personal responses that people have to, whether it's to literature or to any other subject in a sense, over sort of rote ways of writing papers as a college student. But it translates well into a general approach to life almost.
Well, that's kind of you to say that. I'm very proud of that book because I thought about it for many years and realized that having taught badly by really not examining the situation that students were in, I got this idea that I'd try out a class in which I did something radically different, and I found that it worked. And yet it created a kind of pedagogical difficulty which I hadn't foreseen, because after I'd taught this class, one of my students came up to me and he said, you know, I write a lot better now that I've worked with this, and I've got more ways of approaching an essay, and I've got a greater fluency in my writing, and I feel much more comfortable about it. And I said, gee, we're doing okay so far. Anything bad? He said, no, it's fine. He said, but I have to say this, that the whole book is totally useless. And I said, well, that's a bit of a downer. What do you mean by that? He said, well, if I take this method into, and he mentioned another teacher's name on the faculty, he said, he'll say, go and do something with this, you know, this creative expletive, because it's not going to take any notice of it in my class. I've got a way of your write of, that I'm trying to teach you to write papers in my discipline, which has got nothing to do with this. And so I thought, gee, I wonder if that student is speaking truth. And that worried me a lot. So I thought, I've got to try and write a book in which at least there's some humour and a strong sympathy with the predicament that students find themselves in. And they find themselves in a predicament which goes back to the 19th century, to 1830, roughly, where people following Matthew Arnold and the Great Reform Bill and that emergence of a populace that was getting literate, but they didn't know how to be literate properly, so we have to teach them. And so when it comes to writing, let's reduce everything to a very simple paradigm. And that paradigm will be, say what you're going to say, give 3 points to back it up, and then say again what you've said. And this method of writing, which is pretty well universal in America, to me is an absolute disaster. And it took me a long while to see what one could do about it. And I realized what you have to do is to give permission to students to be themselves.
Yes.
And instead of sitting down working as you would doing a filling in the colours on a
picture. Right, a paint by numbers.
Playing by numbers, or there's lots of other clichés.
Mm-hmm.
And either follow the so-called hourglass or the five parrot. I'd rather call it the hourglass method. They felt that they were being kind to these students by giving them something simple, whereas in fact they're being very condescending. There was also a hidden dimension, and this is hardly ever mentioned. There's a political dimension to writing, which is very hidden, and it says something like this. We want our students to write well, but not so well that they criticise us, particularly that they criticise our way of teaching writing.
Right.
Now, I don't think the people who followed Matthew Arnold had that consciously in mind any more than they had the class structure consciously in mind. But it's there. It's deeply imbricated in the whole of the approach to writing. And I wanted to get out of that by putting forward another paradigm which said, nearly all people are capable of writing well, just as they are capable of speaking well. They have to have some practice and they have to have the right model in their head. So how do you get the right model? And I thought about that for a long while. I think I've twigged it now. What you have to do is to give your students plenty of practice in free writing. I call it prose of personal record and reflection. And so you're telling things about something that happened in your life that you might think would be interesting to someone else. It can be imaginary, but if it's based on something real. So close your eyes, think of the person that you really hate a lot. See their face, their figure, the way their hair's done. Listen to their voice. Okay, now write, and write fast. You never have any difficulty with this. They've got someone that they really hate and they can write about that. What you're trying to do, because you've got a hidden political dimension too, you're trying to get them used to the fact of writing, oh, it's not such a bad thing to do. But you get in to say, look at the paper and say, doing this is not a bad thing. You know, I'm discovering something. So
it's not surprising that we would meet some resistance. It's a liberationist kind of
theology.
Well, it is akin to liberationist theology, but that's precisely the problems that liberationist theology met when it tried to liberate the Central and Southern American Church from the Vatican.
That's right.
It's the problems that Paulo Freire and others, liberationist pedagogy, met. And
it's very, very, very perceptive that you say that. I would make a little bit of a proviso there and say that in my case, I don't have a theology to substitute. There's only a way of writing authentically or not.
Right.
What you have to find is a way to get the students to be authentic in what they're saying. You don't worry too much about grading personal reflection if you're trying to get kids to write, your students to write authentic academic papers. I believe that I want to make my students write good academic papers, and there's not just one way of doing it. There are many ways of doing it, but they should have sound argument, they should have sound logic, they should have elegance of expression, etc. All those things still apply, but they're writing from the point of view of their own observation. They're authentic in that sense. And I've got a whole scheme for doing that. It's the paradigm that started Montaigne in the 18th century writing essays. Essay means to try out something. So you're trying out something.
Right, to essay.
And you're exploring and you're experiencing that thing that Auden talks about. Auden's got a couple of very good remarks on this. How can I know what I think before I see what I say? So you're using your essay as a form of discovery in the same way when you write a poem. Why not forget about the rules and just write as eloquently as you can about the situation that you're in?
That's right.
Students love it.
Yes, they do. They respond.
Students really like it. And then, and this is my last word on this for the moment, but I think that it's important to see that many teachers picking up this kind of writing for a start will object. And so you have to teach the students to have it both ways. They can write an academic paper and it can be pleasurable to read. Now, there's an interesting challenge. How are you going to do that?
If what you've heard appeals to you, then the title of the book again is How to Stop Your Papers from Killing You and Me.
Yes, because the teachers suffer as well.
To To conclude, we ask Keith Harrison to read the title poem of his memoir, Not Quite Ithaca.
The town and the island of Ithaca is where Odysseus set out from when he went on his long journey through the known world, which at that time was the Aegean and its shores. It was tiny, in a sense, but that was the whole world. And I was thinking about my own journey, which is nothing like his because he had these marvellous adventures, but it was still nonetheless a journey where I set out from Australia as a young man and I went round the world and I did all these things that are mentioned in this autobiography. And I'm not quite back home yet because it's very hard to come home. It's a double-edged thing. You're grateful to come home, but you've had so many other experiences that you realise that home is largely an emotional thing. It's largely where your loved ones are. But you've got these other things that your loved ones don't know about. And so you're living a sort of double life. That's what I try to emphasise in this poem. It's Minnesota winter. You know, it's Minnesota winter moving into just the time of thaw. And I had a farm on the edge of town, so it felt I was way out in the country and I looked out my kitchen window. Not quite Ithaca. Home by myself in my draughty house. November snow splatting down. Wet stuff that slides off the apple boughs. Two nights ago I stopped a fat raccoon in the headlights as he toppled a trash can. Black ears of a fox and jewel eyes white circled like a clown's. Then he melted back into the sleeve of darkness. Today I look for that hairy smudge on the white page of the paddock. Nothing. Only the snowplane spreading all around. This quiet, save for the squeak of my wet finger against the window pane, is 10 miles thick. And so I welcome myself to my house again. I built this bed, great yawning thing, too vast for any couple, 3 times too wide for a bachelor's narrow sleep. Built it of pitch pine and cheap plywood, bought at a country auction years ago. The bolts don't match. I've knocked it apart too often, once in Toronto, twice for garrets in this town. Now it's grown into the conscience of the house. Not grafted, though, to any olive root, nor decked with damasks of Indian tooth design. Oddly, the sherbet bearers who used to float at evening through the door to lay me down and soothe my limbs with oils from Nineveh and Samarkand don't come by any more. Being too idle to undo the thing again, I shall maybe die in it, but maybe not today. Above it, a great painting by Peter de Hooch, a man and a snivelling kid in a courtyard, 1658. Deftly placed, every flag and brick burns clear in the moist light. The broom, obedient to the painter's fabulating eye, leans correctly on the wall. The courtyard door frames a second woman. White paper surrounds them all. The prints buckled. It curls from the masonite. The whole thing's wrongly angled. Beside it, the window frames the golf hut, from where all summer long they putt on the opulent green. Summer's gone underground. The workmen keep indoors today, honing purple hands. Here I am, in my middle years, in the wastes of white America. Something has slid away. I wait for the voices of my daughters, who might flounce in now, snow in their hair, any week now. Meanwhile, it's me and the raccoon. He's out there, somewhere, surely. Home, but not quite Ithaca, where the waves churn shingle up the yellow shore. Not quite, not quite. But since, pace the story of your perpetually renewable Ulysses, who, after the thrumming of the harp, had stopped, and all the colour drained from the day, propped himself against that olive root, and fought the queer taste that thickened in his throat, and died unsinging, a prince of absences. Since I have chosen to arrange things in this way, I am the husband of these frozen fruit trees, these minutes that drip from the eaves. And it seems, quiet mister, that it must do. It must exactly do.
Over the past three episodes of Poetry on the Radio, we've spoken with now Canberra-based poet, translator, and versatile literary figure, Keith Harrison. Next week, our guest will be Melbourne-based poet Anne M. Carson. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle. At Smith's Alternative in Civic on Monday, November 20, That Poetry Thing presents Kerry Greer and Adrian Caesar. Kerry Greer is an award-winning Western Australian writer who received the Vinnie Holgram Prize for Environmental Poetry in 2021. She writes often about grief and what comes after loss. She will join the reading by Zoom to read from her The Sea Chest. Adrian Caesar will read from his forthcoming sixth collection, Dancing Man. He has also written several books of literary criticism, a multi-award-winning non-fiction novel, The White, and the novel The Blessing, which was long-listed for the Voss Award in 2016. This month's poetry reading at Manning Clark House on Thursday, November 23 at 7 p.m. will feature Anne M. Carson and Angela Costi from Victoria and Amelia Walker from South Australia, while they are in Canberra for the annual conference of the Australasian Association of Writing Programs. That's at the Manning Clark House, 11 Tasmania Circle in Forest, on Thursday, November 23 at 7 p.m. The University of Canberra Centre for Creative and Cultural Research is offering two poetry workshops soon. On Tuesday, November 28, Oz Hardwick will lead a two-hour workshop on poetry collaboration. Who said that? Collaborative writing, while he is in Canberra for the AAWP conference. In the workshop, Hardwick will use an array of visual stimuli, both images and texts, to explore how fragments and brief encounters can stimulate collaborative work in voices which may not be one's own. Search online for University of Canberra OZ Hardwick Workshop. Then on Saturday, December 2 at the University of Canberra, Poetic Movements will hold a workshop, Visual Poetry 101, with poetry book illustrator Karen Florence. The half-day poetry workshop is for people who'd like to experiment with ways to present poetry visually, with such methods and media as collage, stamping, redaction, typewriting, and pens and paints. Search online for University of Canberra Visual Poetry 101. Applications are open for the Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award for Female Poets, hosted biennially by the University of Sydney. The Bell Award offers $40,000 to the author of a collection of between 50 and 80 pages. Entries close on Monday, December 18. To visit the submission portal, search online for University of Sydney Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award 2023. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atria Musica de Madrid.